Hi, this is Tess Vigeland, and you're listening to the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of September 3rd, 2010. If you're enjoying an end-of-summer escape this weekend, here is some fodder for the trip home. Did you book this little getaway online? Did you post about it on Facebook, maybe? Did you use a credit card to buy gas or a hotel or maybe groceries for your campsite? Well, if you did, you left an ocean of data in your wake. And corporate America is using it right now to figure out how to sell you something. It's called data mining. And Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explores the $10 billion industry and what exactly it knows about us.
I'm grocery shopping at Albertsons, and when I check out, I hand over my member ID card.
Oh, can I give you my my card?
I get a discount on my groceries, and Albertsons gets information on everything I just bought. Along with my receipt, the computer spits out a coupon for a dollar off Skinny Cow ice cream sandwiches, which I buy all the time, and Us Weekly, which, well, I'm just trying to stay well informed.
Thank you.
Those smart coupons are just the tip of the $100 billion data mining industry. Every time you search for something online, swipe your credit card, or pull up directions on your cell phone, that action creates a little module of data about you. Data compilers collect that information and sell it, usually millions of records at a time, to marketers who use it to target consumers. Robert Grossman heads the National Center for Data Mining.
This allows better targeting with less effort that can be more widely used by more companies and hopefully increase their margins.
Collecting data is just the beginning. Then someone needs to make sense of it. Someone like data analyst Peter Harvey, CEO of IntelliDyne, a travel company which was looking to sell high-end vacation packages to Asia, recently came to Harvey with data on millions of potential customers.
We passed 5,000 data elements across them and figure out which of them are most likely to travel.
The attributes of the Asian traveler? When I'm 64. Turns out if you're married, a farmer, ex-military, and over 65, you want to go to Asia. Harvey says data mining can double or triple the response to an ad, and companies will be able to hone in on potential customers even more precisely as data gets more individualized. Sites like Google, Facebook, and Foursquare track what you're buying, what you're looking to buy, and where you are. Andreas Weigand teaches data mining at Stanford.
Traditionally, companies knew transaction data. They knew how many latte macchiatos were sold at this location. They didn't really know who they were sold to.
And now?
The company could very well know who the person is based, for instance, on his mobile phone's ID, and could have the coffee ready before the customer even orders it.
Virtually every large company mines its data. It's how Amazon and Netflix come up with those recommendations that entice you to buy another book, another movie. It's how iTunes knows that if you like this song, it should try to sell you this song. IntelliDyne's Peter Harvey says our data is pushing advertising to a whole new level.
Marketing will move from static to dynamic. And then within dynamic, it'll be the rate of change and how fast you can do it.
More like how fast you can make sense of it. Demand is booming for analysts who build the computer models that can synthesize all this data for marketers. Eventually, most of the ads you see will be tailored to you, which sounds great. But what about our privacy? Andreas Weigand says we lost that the minute we logged on.
Maybe privacy was just a blip in history. It started when people moved to cities where they had places to hide. And it ended with the internet, when basically there was no place to hide left.
My privacy in exchange for a dollar off ice cream sandwiches. Well, I guess it's a fair trade.
But is it really a fair trade? We'll have part two of Stacey's story later in the show. Troubled homeowners are certainly aware that financial transactions can follow you around. A foreclosure will affect your credit scores and your ability to borrow for years. That's one of the reasons for the various mortgage modification programs put in place by the Obama administration. But as we've reported before, the effectiveness of those programs is questionable, to say the least. The investigative journalism group ProPublica has been looking into it, and one of their reporters, Paul Keel, joins us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you talked to more than 300 homeowners. Describe for us their experience so far in these programs.
Well, we characterized it overall as a nightmare, and that's a pretty fair characterization, yeah. I think. The average time that someone had been trying to get a modification, which we counted from the time that they reached out to their lender, was about 14 months. People on average had to send the same documents, they said, six times.
Oh.
And then there's all sorts of things about documents being lost by the servicer, being given wrong information by employees when you call up the call center and that sort of thing.
Well, let's play a piece of tape from one of the individuals that you interviewed. His name is Wallace. He's from Baltimore, Maryland. And here he is talking about his experience so far.
I was in a loan modification process and I couldn't get any closure. Nobody would tell me anything from Chase Home Finance. They kept saying, oh, it's in the mail. It's in the mail. I grew up poor. I used to hear my mother say it's in the mail. It's not in the mail. Chase called me and they actually told me to miss two payments.
Now, I heard this tape, and this is not the first time I have heard that a bank is telling people to actually go ahead and miss the payments. Why are banks doing this? And what did Chase say when you contacted them about Wallace?
Well, first of all, as what they say, they generally give somewhat of a boilerplate reply in terms of that they're doing the best they can and
yeah.
to find the solution for the homeowner and that sort of thing. As for why the banks might be telling people this, what happened definitely in the first 6 months of the program, and we think has continued to happen, is that people who were keeping up with their payments, who basically were doing everything in their power to make those payments, they were kind of put to the end of the line. The people who were 2 months or more behind were the ones who were being considered first. It's kind of an autopilot sort of dummy process for how those people are considered. If you're not even missing any payments yet, they kind of have to look at your financial picture to make a determination as to whether you're really telling the truth that you can't make your payments.
Now, another person you interviewed, David Moe, he's 70 years old, a retiree. He just has had enough. His home is now in foreclosure. He shared something with you that was new to me. Let's take a listen to that.
The man across the street came over one day and he said, I got a call from Chase. And they said that you're behind on your mortgage and they can't get a hold of you. And they want me to tell you to call them. I was horribly embarrassed.
Now, Paul, I had never heard of that, a bank actually going and calling the neighbor. How does that happen?
Well, I think it happens because you have an industry that's sometimes pretty confused about whether it's trying to help homeowners or whether it's mainly in the business of collections. And actually what happens at some of these banks is you have a collections department and you have what's called the loss mitigation department. And it may happen that a homeowner is working with the loss mitigation department, talking about their modification and so forth. And then they're getting separate calls from collections people saying, you know, make your payment, make your payment.
Where do you find homeowners are placing the blame at this point? Are they really focusing their anger at the banks or at the government's loan modification program?
Well, I think there's plenty of anger, so there's plenty of places to direct it,
yeah.
Is the short answer of that. A lot of frustration with their congresspeople, and it's actually one thing that I found interesting is that members of Congress have been flooded with calls from constituents, and some offices have even kind of dedicated staffers to this sort of thing, and they've kind of turned into housing counselors in a strange sort of way. And, you know, one major frustration is that there's not like really a place to go with these sorts of complaints. And that's definitely something I hear very frequently.
Paul Keel is a reporter with the investigative news organization ProPublica, and we've been talking about their look into the government's loan modification system. Thanks so much for the stories.
All right. Thanks a lot.
And you can find a link to ProPublica's loan modification report at marketplace.org. And a quick update on a story we've been following the last few weeks. Beverly Davis has been trying to raise money to buy back her three-bedroom house in Fairburn, Georgia. It went into foreclosure earlier this year. She'd been selling cornbread to try to buy the house back when it went on the auction block, which happened this week. She joins us again. Welcome back, Beverly.
Oh, thank you.
All right, so tell us what happened with your bid for the house.
The contract was awarded to another person.
Oh.
And this is, well, you know what? It didn't even bother me. I didn't flinch, because when you walk out on faith, you have to expect negative things to make it look like you didn't win, and it happens all the time.
Hmm.
Two things can happen. One, there's a possibility at the closing everything will fall through and they'll put the house back on the market. If the closing goes through and they win the house and everything is fine, then I'm still going to find out who bought it and make another offer.
So how much were you outbid by?
It really wasn't that much, to be honest with you. And I must share this story because I haven't really told people how much money I raised. I was a little bit shy, actually a lot shy.
Yeah.
But that's okay, though. At least I'm closer now to make an even larger offer. And if they say no, then I will know that I have tried every single thing that I know to do, and I will move on with grace and peace and keep doing what I know to do, and that's to never give up and to make all of my dreams come true.
So can you give us a dollar figure?
$54,000.
$54,000 is what you raised?
Yeah.
On cornbread?
It wasn't just strictly selling cornbread mixes or just a cornbread skillet sets, although those sales have been dynamite, but it's the donations that people are sending in and saying, you know what, I've been where you are, and I'm going to wish you the best, and they send in very sizable donations. Plus, it ties into a story that people can relate to. People know what it feels like to be unemployed and not able to pay your bills when you want to pay your bills.
Yeah.
On top of that, they're inspired that it's, you know, that you come back and fight back. You don't give up. It's amazing. I'm about to get emotional, but it's just that people care. Okay, sorry. A little emotional,
it's okay.
But it's a good thing.
Hey, absolutely. They say that recessions bring out the entrepreneur in people, and I guess that's what's happened to you, huh?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. So I'm thinking clearly outside of the box, thinking in terms of creating multiple prosperous streams of income. I never want to struggle like I did before. That was the most humiliating thing I've ever gone through.
So it's thinking outside the box of cornbread that has gotten you here, right?
That's right.
Well, Beverly, congratulations on the effort. Good luck on whatever happens with the house. And thanks so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's the time in the show when we take your money questions. Here to help us out is our good friend and MSM personal finance columnist, Liz Pulliam-Weston. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Tess.
So any plans for this holiday weekend?
We're going to take it fairly easy, but we're going to take advantage of the fact that hotel rates drop on Monday night. And we are going to go and spend the night at a hotel at the end of Labor Day weekend.
Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Is that a general rule?
Typically, yeah. If you go before a big holiday, like before Memorial Day or right after Labor Day, if your kids aren't already back in school, you can take advantage of some great rates.
Ah, nice little staycation in the area.
Yeah. We're going to have a good time, go out to the ocean and play around and have a good time.
Oh, that sounds just lovely. Well, if you've got any money questions you'd like to get off your chest, do give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Shall we go to the phones?
That sounds like a great idea.
All right. Well, Steve is with us from Philadelphia, PA. Hi, Steve.
Hi, is this Tess?
It is. It's Tess and Liz. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. It's really great to be speaking with a major celebrity.
Well, major, I don't know, but we appreciate that you listen to the show. How do you listen to us there in Philly?
Usually by radio, and I stand next to it without moving for a whole hour.
Wow.
That's a devoted fan, Tess.
Well, in my home, we have the peanut gallery applauding in the back.
And what are they applauding?
They're applauding that I'm listening to something intelligent for once.
Well, have you been having a good summer?
Oh, what's there not to like about summer?
Mm,
you know, as a newly retired teacher, this is what I lived for. There are three favorite words of every teacher, June, July, August.
So now you're in permanent August.
Well, now permanent August, so I'm not complaining.
Very nice.
Yes.
When did this happen? Is this really recent?
Yes, this was this last June.
Well, so how are you liking retirement so far?
How do I like it? I love it. I love it. Yes, I'm not like, I guess, the stereotypical male who hovers around not knowing what to do with himself. I retired so that I could do things that were difficult while I was still at work.
Like what?
Well, writing, reading, and traveling. And
yeah.
When people ask me what I plan to do, I said those three things.
Well, so it sounds like you've done a lot of great planning. How can we help you out?
Well, in listening to your program, I was reminded of a question that our financial planner had been asking us for some time at long-term care insurance.
Uh-huh.
So when you brought it up years ago, we weren't really in a position to think about it, not that we were much younger, but we really didn't want to be bothered. When I retired, of course, he was waiting at the door asking me. Not really, but he did bring it up again, and I said, well, now that I have the time, I will look into it. And I thought, why not ask Tess, because she knows everything and also has experts on to know beyond what she knows.
All right. It's an excellent question, and it's one that we get often. It's a very confusing product for a lot of people to wrap their minds around. So let's start first of all with, when is a good time to start thinking about long-term care insurance?
Actually, probably the first time your financial planner brought this up to you was the best time to think about, because the rates tend to be the best when you're still in your 50s. I mean, the younger you start, the better they are. What it's designed to pay for is the custodial care that you may need if you can't do daily activities for yourself, bathing, dressing. It's generally thought of as nursing home insurance, although it can provide help at home as well. This is stuff that's typically not covered by Medicare, which will cover all your other medical expenses.
And it's typically not something we think about when we're in our 50s.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of a hard thing to, you know, again, wrap your mind around. And the other thing that's a big problem with this insurance is that a lot of the companies that have offered this have not had a great track record.
Uh-huh. You mean track record in providing for the care?
No, in pricing it properly.
Oh, I see.
They price the policies too low. So people signed up for it, paid the premiums for years and years, and then suddenly their premiums doubled or even tripled because the companies realized they weren't properly putting aside the right amount of money to cover the benefits that people needed.
And what about the benefits that they were getting out of it once they started using it?
Well, that's the problem, is that a lot of people had to drop the insurance right when they needed it because they couldn't afford it.
Ugh.
That's a little underhanded, isn't it?
Well, you know, there's people who think it was deliberately done, but this can happen with a new insurance product where they just didn't know what their experience was going to be. A lot of companies are pricing it better, but you still have to be, you know, thinking about the fact that what you pay now may go up in the future.
Yes, that I'm aware of.
Is it, Liz, something that you recommend for everyone, anyone?
Well, here's the general guideline. If you don't have much in the way of assets, you're probably going to wind up on what's called Medicaid. Hmm. And that is the program that covers the poor. If you have more than a certain amount, and the amount varies by financial planner, generally more than $1 million of assets, maybe more than $2 million of assets, and you don't particularly care about leaving, you know, a legacy to your kids, then you may be able to self-insure. In other words, you pay for it out of your own pocket. If you're somewhere in the middle, you should at least look at it. But again, we're going to run up against the issue of, by the time most people get around to looking at it, it may not be affordable.
So you're saying that what amount should provide sort of a cushion?
Well, that is really the key question, isn't it? Because, I mean, for any type of insurance, you're trying to figure out what might happen to you and how much it might cost.
Exactly. When most people need care, it's usually for a period of 2 years or less. Hmm. So one way to think about this is maybe insuring yourself for 3 years. Now, that doesn't give you the kind of catastrophic coverage I like to see with insurance. I mean, that's what the insurance is really there for, the expense.
Right, right. We've always felt that with any kind of insurance. You're not paying for the little things. You're paying for the catastrophic things.
Exactly. That's the proper way to use insurance. And again, here we kind of stand it on its head, because with long-term care, getting that much coverage, in other words, as much coverage as you might need, you know, given all the worst-case scenarios, is probably going to be too expensive for a lot of people. So maybe looking at limiting the payout period could make it more affordable. Have you talked about premiums with your planner?
No, we haven't yet.
Okay. Well, that may stop the discussion right there. I mean, you do want to talk to them about different, you know, payout periods and different waiting periods to see if you could find a policy that's, you know, affordable to you. But as I said, when you're starting in your mid to late 60s to look at this, it may already not be affordable.
Well, we're just planning to pull the plug on one another. So not only would it save on electricity bills, but on any possible long-term care insurance.
Hey, great question. Thanks so much for the call.
Well, Well, thank you so much, and I appreciate your advice, and we will talk about it with our planner.
Terrific.
And see what happens.
All right. Thanks so much.
So thank you again.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's go to Robin. She's in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, and you?
I'm well, thank you.
And how do you listen to the show there in North Carolina?
On WFAE, then also online.
Now, I hear that you have something a little in common with Steve, but you sound a little too young to be considering retirement.
Oh, my question doesn't have to do with retirement. No, I'm not there yet.
No,
but
no.
I do have something in common because I work in the retirement services industry.
So what do you know about long-term care insurance?
What do I know about it?
Yeah.
I actually have it. I've worked with my financial planner and got that set up, yes.
May I ask how old you are?
I'm... Don't tell anybody here at work that that's my age. I've got them fooled.
No, of course not. Of course
so don't
not.
Put that on the air.
It's just between us. It's just between us. So you have to think about retirement every day. What's your idea of a perfect retirement?
Oh, wow. That's a tough question. You know, I actually am concerned about that because I always go, okay, it's Tuesday morning at 8:30 and you're not going into the office. What are you doing? I think it's some combination of work and leisure. I don't think it's completely one or the other.
Are you thinking that you would like to continue your current job, or is this one of those, you know, second career?
Yeah, I'm one of those people thinking about that encore career, although I'm not quite sure what it is at this point.
Right, right. What do you find are the major concerns that people have about retirement when you're talking to them about it?
Running out of money.
Yep.
How do I know how much I need? Will I run out of money?
Yep. Liz, that is a question we get here every single day.
Yeah,
absolutely. And the calculations are... You know, even with all the online tools that you can have, you just never feel comfortable that you're doing enough.
I will tell you, I recently had a conversation with my hairdresser who is young. The salon offers a 401k plan. I felt like I was in the chair doing a one-hour enrollment meeting.
Good for you for doing that work.
Giving her all the, you know, what she needed to do, explaining why she shouldn't give up the match.
Atta girl.
You know, I've been living with this for years because I've worked in this industry. It's all so clear to me. People are so confused about this.
Oh, I know. And rightfully so. You got to figure out how long you think you're going to live. You got to figure out how healthy you think you're going to be.
Right. And at age 25, how do you think about that?
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I do have to ask you, though. I mean, spending so much time talking about the 401k, I hope your hair is okay.
You know what? I just sent a note to a friend of mine with a new picture on LinkedIn, and her comment back to me was, your hair looks great.
Oh, good.
Oh, so we should all have conversations with our hairdressers about retirement.
Not only am I maxing out my 401k, but I'm having a good hair day.
Awesome.
Well, so obviously you do not need our help with your retirement planning. What can we help you with?
I recently checked my credit report. All of my accounts looked okay. I did notice that under the record of requests for my credit history, that a First USA, that was the organization, had made requests almost monthly since late 2009.
Hmm.
And my understanding is that doesn't affect my credit score, but still it seemed odd. So I Googled them. Apparently, I wasn't alone.
Huh.
There were a lot of comments along the same lines, and there were two things that stood out to me. One person had done some research and said they found out that this First USA was connected to Chase Bank. And that made sense because I've been receiving regular mailings from Chase to get their credit card. And I have to shred them and recycle them, and I kind of wish they'd save a few trees. But, you know, I was willing to ignore that. But then another person noted that they were a junk debt buyer using the name of a bank and somehow associated with trying to sue people for a debt you don't owe.
Huh.
And it was very interesting because recently I started getting recorded calls about collection of a debt.
Oh, good Lord.
And obviously, I don't have any delinquent debts. You know, my credit report was fine. So I thought it was ironic that I was being annoyed by one company that wants to give me credit and another that thinks I have an outstanding debt.
A little bit of a disconnect here.
And my question is, do I just ignore this? Do I write to these organizations over this kind of an issue?
Well, first of all, Liz, I think that all of us, when we check our credit reports, will see that banks are checking up on us. But does this sound kosher to you?
Well, usually the banks that are checking up on you are the ones you're already doing business with.
And that was correct. I saw those, and they were very periodic, and it looked appropriate to me.
Yeah,
Yeah. So what do you know about this First USA?
Well, there are some companies that buy lists of pre-screened names, mm-hmm. you know, marketing lists from the credit bureaus. This could be something that this particular bank is doing. And as you said, it could be either way. It could be associated with the Chase offers you keep getting. I don't know that it's connected with the collection agency, but it could be. So either way, if it's not a hard inquiry and not affecting your score, I wouldn't worry about that part too much. But I would probably do something about the collection calls, not because anything's likely to come from it. I mean, I don't think they will continue to pursue you.
And that would show up on her credit report,
that
would it not?
If they stuck a collection on that wasn't yours, you know, you do want to be concerned about that. But just the annoyance factor, because a lot of these robocalls just don't stop. See, these companies are buying the debts for pennies or even fractions of a penny on the dollar. And it's no big deal for them to set up these robocallers. And they find that some people, even if they get the wrong people, will pay the debt because they're so afraid of having damage to their credit reports. If you can find the name of the company and its address, you send them a letter and say, I'm not the person you're looking for. Stop contacting me.
Okay.
Under federal credit reporting laws, they are required to stop.
Great.
All right, Robin, thanks for the call.
Well, thank you so much for the information. I really appreciate it. I will pass it on to others who were interested in this as well.
Terrific. Excellent. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, and finally, we have Craig. He's on the line from Syracuse, New York. Hi, Craig.
Hello.
How do you listen to the show there in Syracuse?
Through WRVO.
WRVO. Terrific. You happen to be near retirement age?
No, I'm actually 22.
So you've got a long way to go. So if you're not calling about retirement, perhaps a student loan?
Yeah, something like that. It's my credit card debt and my loan. I currently have about $6,000 in credit card debt, just from general use. It's not from school or anything like that.
Okay.
And the interest rate's really high. It's about, some of it's 23%, some of it's 29%.
Oh, geez.
Yes. And with college loans, as you know, you can get really low interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And my idea was to borrow the student loan money and then pay the money at the lower interest rate.
Oh, my goodness. So you're talking about consolidating your credit card balances into a student loan?
Essentially.
Well, first of all, are you still in school?
I am. I'm essentially, you could say, a freshman sophomore.
Okay. Liz, is that even possible? Can you take out a student loan and use it to pay off your credit cards?
Probably technically, but you shouldn't be doing it because it's essentially fraud. I mean, what you should be using your student loans for is to pay the costs related to education. You know, I have heard of people taking out loans they didn't need and using it to pay for other things. This is the way it typically works. If you were getting federal student loans, you'd have to do the federal student loan
FAFSA.
FAFSA, thank you. The free application for federal student aid. And anything that wasn't covered, you could get a student loan for. The other part of the situation is, you know, I was talking about federal student loans. You can get private loans to cover the gap between, you know, your costs, including living costs.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it is not a good idea. I know that looks like lower rate debt, but it's just, you know, putting yourself into hock with a private lender who can pursue you no matter what. I mean, if things get really bad, you can wipe out credit card debt in bankruptcy. You cannot wipe out student loans. So I would back up and say there's a problem that you've got $6,000 in credit card debt. There's some disconnect between, you know, what you're earning and how you're spending your money. And in the short, you're living beyond your means.
So, Craig, do you think there's any way that you can start paying down that $6,000 in debt so you can just get rid of it?
Well, I've been trying.
Yeah.
The minimum is so high that it's only like a 29% interest, it's paying the interest itself.
All right, then Liz, is there anywhere else where he could potentially roll that credit card debt over into, I don't say, a bank loan that might have a better interest rate for him?
What you might want to do is go to a local credit union that you can belong to and ask them, do you have like a 3-year personal loan that I could roll this debt into and pay that off over time? If that's not an option, then you might want to consider credit counseling. Credit counselors, legitimate credit counselors, have debt management plans that will lower your interest rate so you actually can make some progress on this debt. If you had that debt management program, you probably could get this under control.
That's definitely food for thought, and I definitely, you know, should get in contact with a credit counselor rather than replacing one debt with another.
Yeah, give it a shot. You know, I think you'll find that they're very helpful and they're really there for you. And, you know, the whole budgeting process is helpful as well. So they can help you through that.
Thank you so much.
You bet, Craig. Thanks so much.
And have a good day.
You bet. You too. Bye-bye. All right. Well, that is unfortunately all the time we've got for this week. But do remember, if you've got a money question, our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz Pulliam-Weston, it's been great having you back.
Thanks so much, as always. Thank you.
Enjoy the holiday weekend.
You too.
And remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Earlier, we heard from Stacey Vanek-Smith about all the ways companies keep track of us. They've become experts at reading the fine print behind what we buy and using it to market stuff to us in the future. It's called data mining, and it's more than a little freaky if you stop to think about it. In part two of her report, Stacey shares some personal examples of how this data mining works.
Data compilers have been gathering information on me, where I live and what I buy, since I left for college. Peter Harvey is the CEO of data mining company Intellidyne. He gives me the big picture.
So now we've got Stacy at apartment C on this street in L.A. It has your date of birth as December 1st, 1976.
December 26th, but okay.
You're a frequent internet user, cellular customer, and long-distance user. And it says you are an active credit card user.
Using that and my credit information, data miners slot me into one of 70 lifestyle categories, or clusters.
It put you in cluster number 26.
Which is?
Savvy singles. Savvy single households are well-educated and enjoy upper-middle income and live in multifamily dwelling units.
We're also workaholics, environmental activists, travelers, and mountain climbers, and we spend a lot of our money on fixing up our homes. Companies have been using my savvy singlehood as a way to sell me things for years. That might explain why I get so many Pottery Barn catalogs and promotions for Las Vegas getaways. I'm not actually that into Vegas, and that can be the problem with those broad categories. But things are getting a lot more personal. Because every time I look something up on my phone, send an email, or use my credit card, I'm leaving a trail of digital breadcrumbs.
Well, I know a fair amount about you now.
That's Robert Grossman, head of the National Center for Data Mining at the University of Chicago. He mined my information from Google and Facebook.
I know your hometown, which is Boise, Idaho. I know where you work. You worked pretty hard. But in the evening, you would watch TV shows like Glee, look at travel locations. You spend a lot of time looking at women's shoes and cosmetics.
I guess I like shoes and cosmetics. Grossman says marketers could use that information to send me ads for sandals and lip gloss after I got home from work and before I settle into...
I could see that you're interested in doing a trip to Berkeley, San Francisco.
Actually, I was in Berkeley, and Grossman noticed some differences in my behavior when I was there.
Los Angeles, you're interested in everything from museums to where to eat breakfast to where to get drinks. And Berkeley, you're interested in cakes, bars, and wine restaurants.
So in L.A., I'm interested in where to eat and where to get cocktails, and in Berkeley, I'm interested in where to eat and where to get wine. Can I just say I don't drink that much? But when I was in Berkeley for work, I did look up wine bars, and Grossman says the next time I'm there, I might get a text message from a wine bar near my hotel. So that's a little scary, and that's just Google. Then we got to Facebook, where marketers can find out information about the music and books I like, my real birthday, my relationship status, see pictures of what I did last weekend, get a heads up on what I'm planning to do this weekend, and see who my friends are, which Grossman says is marketing gold.
The likes of friends is one of the most predictive variables of your own likes.
So they know where I live, what I buy, my nutritional habits, what I watch, and who my friends are. What are they going to do with all of it? Grossman says they're going to try to sell me stuff. Stuff I'll probably want.
I think this is just going to make targeting more relevant. From that viewpoint, I think this is very, very good. So I would offer you women's shoes, cosmetics, travel, and TV shows.
Can I just say that I am not that into shoes? Anyway, Grossman points out that every day I trade my data for things I want. I let Amazon store my credit card information because it's convenient. I take online surveys to get discounts. And for no reason at all, I tell my 300 Facebook friends that I saw Twilight and liked it. But I am not just the sum of my data parts.
This is a very small portion of your life. It's just the part that can be monetized.
Because there is a lot more to me than shoe shopping and bar hopping, I did my senior thesis on Beckett. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
The jobs picture for last month had a bit of a Rorschach to it. You could see gloom, another 54,000 jobs gone from U.S. payrolls, or you could see growth. Most of the losses were from temporary census jobs, and the private sector actually added 67,000 positions. Well, today we profile job seekers who actually found work. Youth Radio's Maya Cueva followed two newly minted teachers in search of their first classroom. Budget cuts here in California have made that task much harder, and finding the perfect job required a whole lot of homework.
Nessa Mahmoudi graduated from UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Education this spring. She was 24, just starting her career, and, like everyone else in her class, facing one of the toughest job markets in memory. But Mahmoudi had a strategy.
You know, in my mindset, I'm like, where do they pay the least? That's where they need me the most.
In the San Francisco Bay Area, that means Oakland Unified, where teachers are among the lowest paid in the region. But Oakland Unified didn't exactly need Mahmoudi. With $122 million in budget cuts this fiscal year, dozens of tenured teachers were already being laid off, and district administrators told Mahmoudi not to bother applying. But she ignored them.
Though I know I don't really have a lot of space to be picky because there's not a lot of jobs, I figure it's best to go in with a mentality that there is something that I am looking for and that the school needs to be a fit for me and not just whatever job pops up.
Burnout is high for new teachers, so finding the right school goes a long way towards keeping teachers happy. Mahmoudi's former professor, Ingrid Serochi, coaches students to be selective about jobs. But with less than 10% of her students landing jobs by graduation,
they feel like they're not going to be in a position to be able to choose the kind of school they want to teach at. They're going to have to take, in some cases, the jobs that they can get.
But Mahmoudi kept her sights set on Oakland.
Because though she's saying, don't look, in August, they're going to need teachers. Like, it's just the reality. And we kind of are just having the faith.
Mahmoudi's faith paid off well ahead of schedule. In July, an East Oakland elementary school hired her to teach first grade in a dual immersion English-Spanish program. It was pretty much her dream job. But she was lucky. Many teachers who play the waiting game don't end up with offers until after the school year has started.
I couldn't imagine being a first-year teacher and trying to start your classroom and, you know, get your classroom culture going a week into school when they've had a week of substitutes.
That's Emily Chan. She was one of the few teachers lucky enough to have a job by graduation. Early into her spring semester, Chan started applying to charter schools, which had some of the only jobs available. She landed a middle school science position at Making Waves Academy in Richmond, California. Because her school hasn't been hit as hard by state budget cuts, Chan expects to have more resources than most public classrooms, and more time for staff development. But Chan made other compromises. Her school isn't unionized, there's no tenure, and
they don't actually have a pay scale. It's not like if I work there for however many years, it'll go up. So that's a point of concern a little bit for me.
A concern because Chan has thousands of dollars in student loans to repay on her teacher's salary. Mahmoudi also has school loans, but money isn't her main worry. State budget cuts mean larger class sizes. That's a real challenge for a new teacher.
That I'm afraid of, yeah. I mean, I was in a first grade class with 24 kids, and 24 was fine, but like that's the limit, you know? But it's not going to be the limit.
With the first day of school upon her, Mahmoudi is feeling optimistic. She gets that from her parents, who immigrated from Iran during the revolution. She says they raised her to be idealistic.
But they also raised me to believe that big-scale revolutions are not possible, and that you start with one-to-one work with people.
And this, perhaps, is the biggest worry about the shortage in teaching jobs. That in 5 years, there'll be no one left to do that one-on-one work in the classroom. Analysts say fewer jobs today means people won't train to be educators tomorrow. And eventually, when senior teachers retire, we'll be looking at the opposite problem, a teacher shortage. In Berkeley, California, I'm Maya Cueva for Marketplace Money.
One of the do-gooder trends that's popped up in recent years is showing off our new leaner consumption style. But social critic Andrew Potter says it's not all about doing good for the world. There's more than a little self-interest going on when we shop organic, buy distressed designer jeans, and make our own jam. His book is called The Authenticity Hoax, and I asked him what exactly that means.
What it is in a sense, a successor form of status display, succeeding the old conspicuous consumption we're familiar with. And what has happened, I think, over the past 30 to 40 years, is there's been a shift in the culture where, as we got wealthier, it actually became less socially acceptable to just sort of like engage in raw displays of how much wealth you have or what great taste you have. And so we engage in what I call conspicuous authenticity, displays of consumption or experience that sort of express what a deep person, how spiritual you are.
What are some examples of that?
Things like voluntourism or ecotourism, the idea that you're not just going traveling somewhere, you're going there to actually help out the locals, or you're going there to help preserve the planet. I think the current fetish for the locavore craze, local eating, local meat, local produce, and so on, is an expression of that as well. This idea that I'm not the kind of person who shops just to own something. I shop to sort of sustain a local community that matters to me and my kin.
Well, what's wrong with conspicuous authenticity? What's wrong with ecotourism?
Oh, there's nothing wrong with it at all, except one of the problems is that, like all what economists call positional goods, it's valuable only to the extent to which other people can't really have it. Especially in the food, the locavore movement, one of the most important aspects that people talk about is, I've got this butter, right, that you can't buy in the open market. You need sort of social connections to get it. What I'm trying to point out is that when you wrap up your consumption in a sort of a moralizing guise, it ends up sort of being an almost more pernicious form of status seeking, because it makes it seem like you're actually better than other people and not just simply better connected.
You talk a lot in the book about how marketers and brand strategists are tapping into this these days. Can you give us some examples of that? I mean, obviously, you spend a lot of time talking about Whole Foods.
Yeah, I talk about Whole Foods. And I mean, what's amazing, the beginning of chapter four, I actually list, about 50 different products or services or goods or people that have been promoted on the grounds that they're authentic or they have authenticity. I mean, everything from chainsaws to Sarah Palin, right, has been sort of claimed to be authentic in one way or another. And so it's a great marketing strategy across the board. Authenticity, I think, is kind of like charisma. If you have to say you have it, you know, you don't, right? But it's the more subtle forms of selling of authenticity, where you sell something as not authentic. You sell it as saving the earth. It's the big problem that a product like, or a store like Whole Foods is having, because they're called Whole Paycheck for a reason. But beyond that, they sort of got wrapped up in this whole idea of big organic, right? This idea that they're just sort of adopting the techniques of industrial mass marketing to organic, which nobody really likes, and is sort of undermining the brand in a lot of ways.
You also talk about the one-upsmanship that comes into play here, the keeping up with the authentic Joneses. You say, you know, that there's this trend toward competitive anti-consumption.
Yeah, you have to show that you're not actually connected to the stuff you're buying. The French call it nostalgie de la boue, right? Nostalgia for the mud, this sort of fetishization of poverty. You see that, you know, the hipster movement in Williamsburg, New York, that everyone talks about, this idea that you have a fixed gear bike because you can't afford a proper 10-speed and so on. But I think the way it gets really interesting is in the various ways people are kind of downgrading their houses. You know, you get these amazing stories of people putting no flush toilets in their condominiums in Manhattan, which there's a kind of charming preposterousness to it all, right? This idea that to prove you're more authentic than everyone else, you need to actually live like some kind of third world poverty-stricken aboriginal.
Would you call yourself a conspicuous authenticist or a conspicuous consumer?
Oh, absolutely. And it's sort of the embarrassing part of all of it is that it's actually quite hard to get away from. I mean, I spent far more money than I had. I was put on a big credit card a couple of years ago to go on a big canoe trip in the Northwest Territories of Canada to spend, time away from technology and away from human nature. And that kind of stuff, we all do it. We all like it. What I'm trying to point out is that it might not necessarily make us happy. And it certainly is a lot easier to do when you can at least put something on your credit card.
Andrew Potter is the author of The Authenticity Hoax, How We Get Lost Finding Ourselves. Glad we found you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. It was fun.
And finally, this Labor Day weekend, most of us hope to eventually take a permanent break from our labors. It's called retirement. But retirement is certainly not for our next guest. Sally Gordon is the assistant sergeant at arms at the Nebraska State Capitol Building. She's been in that job for the last quarter century plus, and she started it when she was 75 years old. A couple of weeks ago, she was named America's outstanding oldest worker at 101 years old by Experience Works, a nonprofit that helps older workers find jobs. And she joins us on the line from her home in Nebraska. Welcome.
I'm glad to participate.
It is our honor to have you with us. So I have to ask you, what possibly motivates you to continue working after more than 8 decades in the workforce? I personally can't imagine.
Well, I always say I'm a desperate housewife allergic to housework. So, I've worked ever since I was 16, but I like to work. I like to get dressed. I like people. I'm fascinated by people. They say, why don't you write a book? I said, everyone has a story to tell because, you know, each life is unique.
Well, let's take you back a little bit. What was your first job?
Well, I got my first job when I graduated from high school. I went to Chicago, worked for a while, and I worked at a place called Process Engraving Company, and we had clients from all over the world, like Charlie Chaplin.
Well, let me ask you, you've really had a front seat to the women's movement, the revolution in women in the workforce, and you've been in it for a good chunk of that time. Talk to us about what that was like to watch that happen.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I was expecting my first baby, of course, women who were expecting, they didn't want them in public eye. So they brought my desk and typewriter home, and I worked up until the day she was born.
Huh.
But, you know, I think women don't get credit for what they do. So many times men, for some reason or other, get the better jobs and the better pay, and I don't think it's fair because we are achievers. We contribute to the general good.
Absolutely. So you are 101 years young. Sally, do you ever plan to retire, or are you just going to keep working and working?
No, as long as I can do my job, you know, when I get to the point where I don't think I can do my job, then life goes by at an amazing pace. Perhaps that's why it's called the human race.
Well, I would suggest that perhaps you have a sideline with writing bumper sticker quotes. So that could be a second job for you. How's that sound?
There you go.
Well, Sally Gordon.
Yes, dear.
It has been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Sally is 101 years old, and she is currently the assistant sergeant at arms at the Nebraska State Capitol. And she's just been honored as America's outstanding oldest worker by Experience Works. Thank you so much, and keep going strong there.
It's been a pleasure. A lot of people don't listen to me, and you did. So.
Oh, we'll be listening to you for as long as we possibly can. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jen.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the Great Recession made life hard for millions of people. But in one neighborhood in Tennessee, the suffering is nothing new.
There weren't good jobs here in town. So when there's a downturn, people may say, what recession? We were already there.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Devin Robbins, and Nancy Fargali. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. And be sure to visit us on Facebook. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you're enjoying a rest from your labors this holiday weekend, and we'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term investment strategies built on experience, discipline, and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.